This is BBC Radio 4. All this week, our series The People's Passion has been investigating life in our cathedrals today. Now, in the last of our cathedral conversations, we join Archbishop Rowan Williams and the philosopher John Gray at Canterbury Cathedral for a discussion of belief and belonging.
Here you have this extraordinary nave without chairs today, so you get a sense of the huge scale of it and the clear glass in the windows.
Indeed.
This is the great sort of open space that the cathedral makes available. Then you go up the steps and you enter into a much more complex world. Little chapels, hidden corners, and right at the heart, the high altar, and behind the high altar, the space where the shrine of Becket used to be. If you go down the stairs, you have the crypt, and again, this corona of tiny chapels, little Romanesque chapels, some with medieval wall painting surviving. And the contrast always strikes me when I come in between this big light space here and the, well, it's the rabbit warren of small spaces, complex spaces beyond, the hidden places.
But they have in common that they're, would you agree with this, that they are enclaves of a different kind of thinking and feeling than that which is possible every day in the broader society?
Exactly. And the nave, I think, speaks of the fact that you don't have to fill the space. And I think the message that you don't have to fill the space is one which our culture finds very hard to hear.
I mean, nowadays there would be many who would say that if secular hopes of improvement in the world were given up, there'd be nothing left. Whereas I think the whole importance of an empty space like this would be that if you are a Christian, everything's left. I'm not a Christian myself. I would be, for practical purposes, an atheist. But one of the profound truths, I would call it a truth that Christianity conveys, is this fact of inescapable tragedy and comedy being a permanent, unalterable feature of being human. In other words, not something transitional, not something that we regard as soluble problems, but as permanent discordancies, which are not all bad either.
That's right. It's the soluble problems thing which I think is most disturbing here.
Yes.
Because I don't believe that Christian faith comes in as a solution to problems.
No.
It comes in as the sense of a different frame of reference, a different set of images, a different set of metaphors, a different sense of who or what you're answerable to.
Yes.
None of which has to do, I think, with just mopping up difficulties. And conversations that one has with certain kinds of unbeliever, saving your presence, are often very frustrating because of the assumption that this must be some kind of rival account of what the world is like, and a bad explanation rather than something that isn't, in one sense, an explanation at all.
As I'm sure you are, I'm a great supporter of science in all its legitimate functions, but I don't like the transformation of science into an ideology or a separate project of salvation. We're not far from the situation, I think, here in this very building, we've reached it, in which churches are sanctuaries of doubt.
I think you could call it almost a sanctuary of self-doubt, because you come in here to be questioned. And I think that the kind of space that this is very frequently does speak to people in that way. I am in question. I am not obvious to myself. It's St. Augustine, really. I've become a question to myself. So that when you come into a building like this, you expect to be changed in some way. You expect to enter another world. Which is why another thing that I suppose the building still speaks of is that moment of massive self-questioning and stripping down that the Reformation involved. Two different sorts of stories, the great building up of all the images, all the elaboration of wealth as well as beauty here. And then the Reformation comes in and says, actually, there's something else that has to be said here. Which is why the plain glass here in the nave always strikes me so forcibly. Wonderful stained glass from the Middle Ages, some of the best in Europe. And then you have these bare windows here in the nave, as if to say, don't let the imagination stop the light getting in.
Yes, I suppose the Reformation is significant here as an example, one of many, of course, of the way in which Christianity, like other religions, and even particular buildings like this, very much aren't fixed things.
They constantly
renew themselves, change.
That's right. People imagine that this is something called heritage, which was confected tidily several hundred years ago and has been preserved in aspic ever since. And yet the marks, the thumbprints of people through the centuries, the wearing away of the stones up to the screen on the steps, that sense of the centuries rubbing over it, rubbing things out.
Part of the numinous quality of a place like this, the quality of mystery, the quality of difference from everyday life, is this mixture of human beings who in their natures don't change, with profound change in their circumstances, in what they expect of the church, and even in the physical structure, as you say, of the church itself.
That's right. I don't find that a depressing thought at all.
No, not at all.
Some people will say, "Oh, we're not making any progress, or we're not changing." Well, of course we're not. it's blindingly obvious. Of course, I have an uncomfortable amount in common with the extremely shrewd and mildly corrupt and rather cussed archbishops whose tombs line the chancel here.
And in that respect, it's important that a large open space like this can contain people with very different degrees of depth of commitment.
Yes. I often feel that is precisely why cathedrals are so popular these days. Mm. People come to cathedrals to worship, knowing that they won't have to do a doctrine exam at the door, and also knowing that there are some people for whom this is so serious that almost nothing else matters. I must admit, I don't lose too much sleep about people turning up at Christmas and Easter who are a bit vague about what exactly it's about. And that people do come in at those moments to let the story wash over them and think what it might mean to orient your life somehow in the light of those extraordinary things. Well, that I welcome. For some people, there's cost in accepting that, such deep cost, they immerse themselves totally in it, and it's as real as anything could be. And what they make possible is the flowering of different kinds of space around that, where not everyone is paying the same price, not everyone is involved in the same sense. I feel that very much when I look at Becket's memorial, and when every December on the anniversary of his death, I stand along with several hundred other people in front of the martyrdom there and think, I'm quite glad that somebody has borne the cost in a way that I probably shan't be asked to. But you never know, and it's as well that I stand here once in a while and just remember that cost is the other aspect of it, not just the hospitality or the space.
I'm a skeptic and in some sense even a rationalist, but precisely because of that, I find the Christian narrative of the resurrection more compelling than the prevailing secular humanist narrative of humanity slowly ascending to a higher civilization. And the reason for that is that within the Christian narrative, there's an explicit acknowledgement of the element of the miraculous. Whereas in the secular humanist narrative, the idea is that humans will become more rational. Let's leave aside whether in that understanding of rationality that would really be desirable. But that they become more rational and ascend slowly to a higher order of civilization. Using that very kind of reason, I think you should quite quickly conclude that that's not going to happen. So in the sense of a hope, it seems to me that the hope embodied in a story such as the story of the resurrection is a more profound hope than the rather thin secular idealism which is embodied in notions of progress. So I think it's an immensely valuable time in the life of a place like this cathedral.
We're coming downstairs into the crypt, a very different sort of space, which is the most ancient surviving part of the cathedral. It speaks of foundations, it speaks in its relative darkness of something like coming into a womb of darkness, something surrounding you. And it's also the place where the body of Becket was brought immediately after his murder. During Holy Week, one of the key moments is at the end of the Eucharist on Maundy Thursday, when I bring the bread and wine that has been consecrated down here to the crypt in procession, in silence. The candles are lit at the altar, everything else is in darkness, and the sacrament is placed on the altar, and people come in then over the next few hours to spend an hour or half an hour in silence, in the darkness, with the sacrament. And it seems a very appropriate way of using this space. We're going down into something, we're letting go of something and just focusing on that single silent image an inanimate piece of bread, if you like, and yet the most significant thing in the entire church here down at the foundations.
I think from my point of view, I sometimes say that religions are like poetry, or that they are vehicles for myths. And many people think that if you say that, that means that they're just stories that anybody could make up at any time. And therefore that it doesn't matter which one you believe in. But I think myths, although they can't be true or false in the way that scientific theories can be true or false, myths can be more or less true to the permanent realities of human experience. So there are ways of judging the truthfulness of a myth. What disturbs me in some elements of current thinking is that what to me are clearly myths are taken as facts. In other words, if you're entirely inside the myth all the time, then it seems like a fact. And I find that kind of literalism nowadays much more commonly among non-religious or anti-religious thinkers.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes, that's quite right. And I suppose one reason why I am a Christian and believe Christianity is true is that Christianity provides me with exactly that impetus to go on asking the question, because of that death and resurrection complex at the centre of it, knowing that what you thought, sound like T.S. Eliot now, what you thought mattered doesn't in the context of prayer and silence.
Because what people are letting go of here, I understand, is practically all that could be described in terms of a list of propositions or a creedal system in favour of something more profound, something perhaps a bit like what the poet Keats called negative capability. They're letting in meanings, they're letting in thoughts, they're letting in intimations that they didn't have before. And when I've said in some of the things I've written and broadcast that we'd be better off if we didn't believe in belief, what I mean by belief here is the adamant assertion of some supposedly clear proposition or tenet. And I find that much more now in secular thinking than actually in religious thinking. And I think we would all be better off if we were less prone to that.
I think that's right, because there's a very long-standing and respectable tradition in Christianity of saying what's going on at the top level of your mind in terms of the propositions you're entertaining at any moment and what sense you're making of them is actually not very good as a clue to what's going on in the depths and the foundations of your spirit. It's, I suppose, what lies behind mystical writing about the Dark Night. It's what lies behind that long tradition of saying that the language of the creed and so on is a convenience. It's the least stupid thing we can say. But don't imagine that when you've said it, you've wrapped it up.
And sitting in here, in this crypt, in the dark, for an hour, opens up people to possibilities they wouldn't get. A line of poetry comes to you, Wallace Stevens, green as the night. We couldn't live in a world, humans couldn't live in a world in which everything is blindingly illuminated by the artificial light of reason. We have to actually have, I think, not to abandon reason, but to have a richer conception of what it can do and what it can't do.
There's more than one way of knowing.
Yes.
And I think a building like this, in all sorts of ways, in its shape, in its space, in its decoration, will be saying to people, there's more than one way of knowing.
And also more than one way of not knowing.
Yes.